Even though the word is more and more often in our vocabulary nowadays, it still, for a lot of us, remains in the realm of science fiction or horror movies. The word is biotechnology. Doesn't it have a kind of a scary sound to it in and of itself? Biotechnology. Now, if we rightly understand what's at work in the simple definition of biotechnology, it's not going to concern us as much. But if we then rightly understand what is planned in the future in the realm of biotechnology, it might be scarier than any horror movie and perhaps, well, more bizarre than any science fiction movie you will ever see. We're going to talk about biotechnology and bioethics during this hour of Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Our guest for this hour, Dr. Nigel Cameron, will join us here in just a moment. You can join us as well if you have a question or a comment on biotechnology. We're going to be talking about, well, the brave new world ahead and how there are some questions that are raised by the current state of biotechnology that democracy is not prepared to deal with. And that's one of the things we're going to talk about with Dr. Cameron here during this hour of Issues, Etc. Why should we care about biotechnology? Well, for one, the train has left the station. The questions that will be raised by the future of biotechnology, human cloning, genetic patenting, genetic manipulation, the created becoming the creator or the manufacturer of life, those questions are already on the table. And that's why we ought to care. The promises that are made by actors like Christopher Reeve when he says, look, government ought to be out there working for the greatest good of the greatest number possible. Sounds so very good. But in fact, it's an ethic that if it were consistently followed, Christopher Reeve would have been left to die after his tragic accident, being thrown from a horse, being made a quadriplegic. If the greatest good of the greatest number should be served, well, why keep one man alive? You see, this kind of ethics that biotechnology is operating under today and that government policy is being shaped by today impacts your life as well as mine. Our call-in number, if you'd like to join us with a question on biotechnology, 1-800-730-2727. 1-800-730-2727. We also have an in-studio email address. Feel free to use it during this hour. It is issuesetc@kfuo.org. issuesetc@kfuo.org. Or 1-800-730-2727. Now, we've talked a lot about this in other conversations. We've had Wesley Smith on, and he has talked about big biotech and the dollars and cents issues that surround big biotech. Why is it? Just yesterday we were talking about this, in fact, or day before yesterday, I can't remember. Why is it, say in the case of embryonic stem cell research, why is it that the private sector with all the money, much more money than the government will ever have to spend, why is it that they don't want to invest in embryonic stem cell research? Why is it they're more willing to invest in adult stem cell research that does not involve the destruction of human life in order to harvest stem cells for possible cures? Well, the answer is simple. They don't want to throw their money down a rat hole. What if, however, embryonic stem cell research suddenly experienced an amazing medical breakthrough, a research breakthrough, and it was not necessarily a dead end? It was not the more dangerous of the two stem cell researches. What if it was as profitable? What if it was as fruitful in terms of cures as adult stem cell research seems to be today? Now, then you'd find everybody's money going toward it, but would that make it right? It comes down to this question. I think this is a question that we always will deal with, especially in an age where technology moves faster than we can keep up. Just because we can do something, does that mean we must do it? Does that mean we should do it? There's a certain fatalism at work in the debate over where biotechnology ought to go, human cloning, embryonic stem cell research, abortion, all of those things. There's a certain fatalism, and sometimes even the opponents of embryonic stem cell research, human cloning, and abortion adopt the same fatalistic mindset. Well, look, the technology is moving faster than anyone anticipated. It cannot be stopped. It will move forward. We will be living in the brave new world, whether we want to or not. Is that true? That's a question I'd like to pose to Dr. Cameron when we get him here. Because just because we can do something doesn't necessarily mean that we will do something. Just because we can do something certainly doesn't mean that we should do something. But I do want you to consider for a moment, before our conversation begins, the kind of world that could lie ahead. I say could, not will lie ahead. Consider for a moment the kind of world that is now only dreamt of in science fiction or in horror movies, where the researcher does break through and find a way to patent a human being, a cloned human being, or patent the cells derived from that human being. Think about that. Where the human being is now not only the product of a man and a woman's love, the human being can now be the product of the researcher's desire to get a grant. And with the right technology, he can have himself a human being. Now, he will argue, because it's not the product, technically speaking, of a man and woman's love, it's his to do with as he pleases. You see, before we get to that brave new world, there's going to need to be a policy debate. A policy debate that, I said before, our current democratic system is ill-equipped to deal with. And we'll have to decide whether or not that researcher, if he is able to have for himself through his technological prowess a human being, whether that human being is his to do with as he pleases. Or whether or not the promise he might make about what he could do through researching on that human embryo will outweigh the moral considerations. My daughter asked me a question the other day. She asked about she saw a news story about cloning. And it wasn't human cloning. It was the cloning of kittens. And she saw the picture there on the news of the cute little three-week-old kitten, big bright eyes and fluffy tail, next to its clone. Equally cute? Equally bright eyes? Equally fluffy? She asked me the question. Now, she's 12 years old. The technology is probably beyond her. She said, now, what is that clone? Is that a real cat? I know the first one's real because it had a mom and a dad, but what about the second one? Is that real? Is it really a cat? I had to answer, yes, it is. Now, it's the genetic identical twin of the first cat, but it's just as real and just as much a cat. Now, it would be easy for me to say, no, just a clone, just a copy, just a replica, means nothing. But if I answered that way, what would it mean for the human clone? What if instead of kittens on the TV screen, my daughter and I had seen human babies? Well, there's the first one, bright-eyed, beautiful, wriggling, cooing, and there's the second one. It's clone. Bright-eyed, beautiful, wriggling, cooing. And my daughter had said, well, I know what the first baby is. That's a real human being because that baby has a mom and a dad. But what about its clone? What about that second little bright-eyed cooing being there? Is that real? Is that a real human being? The answer has to be yes. It is a real human being. Otherwise, it's got to be something else, doesn't it? If not human, if not a person, if not deserving of our respect, if not endowed with human dignity, if not our, at least in terms of our civilization, our, in terms of mankind, our brother or our sister, it's something else. And if it's less than human, then it may deserve less than human protection. Now, it's real easy to see that picture in your mind of the baby. It's more difficult to picture it when it's off in some lab, under a researcher's microscope, in a petri dish. And it's too small to be seen. And even when you look at it, it doesn't look much like a human being. Right now, the same picture is being presented to our culture, our society. The very same picture. It doesn't look like bright-eyed cooing babies. It looks like cells in a dish. And our culture, our society, the biotechnological apparatus, our government, our lawmakers, you and me, the voters, are being asked the very same question. So we know what the first thing is. That's a human embryo. But if we clone it and we get something that looks just like it, what is that? Is it still a real human being? The answer there again has to be yes. Otherwise, you know, and this is where the logic kicks in. Otherwise, if that little, what appears to us just to be a bunch of cells sitting in a petri dish is not a human being, and if we can do with it as we please, if we can destroy it for its stem cells, then what about if it's not the cells in a dish, but the embryo in the womb or the baby outside the womb? The reason we ask these questions here on the air on Issues, Etc., is because these are questions that will need to be answered, and we need to answer them now, not after the researchers have decided that just because they can do something, they're going to do something. A little bit later in the program today, in the second hour, Dr. David Johnson of Concordia Publishing House will join us. We're going to talk about the life and challenges of a church musician. What is the role of music in the life of the church and the worship of the church? And music just doesn't happen. We have to have organists and pianists and instrumentalists and choirs. How does it work? We'll be talking about that in the first part of the second hour of Issues, Etc. Then, from 4:30 to 5, we will get reaction to today's California Supreme Court decision about the San Francisco gay marriage licenses. Did you hear this story? It has been decided that the licenses issued under the auspices of the mayor of San Francisco, the thing that got the ball rolling on this whole gay marriage national issue, that those licenses are null and void in the state of California. We'll see whether or not the people who had them and acted upon them will recognize what the Supreme Court in California has said. We'll get some reaction to that from 4:30 to 5. Then, in the third hour of the program, we'll be talking about vocation. Pastor David Peterson, a regular guest here on Issues, Etc., will join us to talk about a Christian in his vocation. Then we'll round off today's program from 5:30 to 6. We'll be talking with someone from Higher Things magazine about confession and absolution. Luther says, "When I urge you to go to confession, I am simply urging you to be a Christian." Lynn Fredrickson is going to join us to talk about confession and absolution in the last part of Issues, Etc. today. Our call-in numbers, if you'd like to join us to discuss biotechnology, 1-800-730-2727 or 505-7850. You can also join us via email, issuesetc@kfuo.org. I mentioned before Christopher Reeve. Now, he's famous now for not only having been an actor and having suffered an accident by which he was rendered a quadriplegic. This is a man who, at least at this current stage in his recovery, depends almost entirely upon others and the technology to keep him alive. He lives every day, for the better part of every day, on a respirator. Cannot breathe on his own, not for extended periods of time. He's become one of the most outspoken advocates for embryonic stem cell research. When he testified before Congress some time back, he employed, and I mentioned this before, a certain ethical framework. And he made it clear. He said that government's responsibility was to work for the greatest possible good of the greatest number of people. The greatest good for the greatest number. Now, this is in ethical circles called utilitarianism. It usually is put in street terms, the end justifies the means. The greatest number of good for the greatest number. Sounds good, doesn't it? I mean, it sounds like if that's how government really operated, then and if that's how society and our ethics really operated, then everyone would come out better. But think for a moment of Christopher Reeve himself. Here is a man who daily depends. Now, he's got the money to pay for his own recovery in his own care. But not everyone does. So let's say someone like Christopher Reeve, and maybe his money might even run out sometime. Someone like Christopher Reeve, if the government's obligation is to see to the greatest good for the greatest number, and if the good of the many outweigh the good of the few, that's the utilitarian ethic. If that is the way things ought to be among us in our ethics and in our public policy, what would have become, not of Christopher Reeve, who's got money to of his own to spend on his recovery, but let's say someone who doesn't. Who picks up the bill? Well, we do ultimately, either through insurance premiums or through a taxpayer dollars or anything like that, right? You and I start paying. Well, enough of those people are going to start impacting the good of the greatest number. So if you consider yourselves among the greatest number, think about it. If our ethics and our policy and our system of government ought to be geared toward providing the greatest good for the greatest number, what would become of someone like Christopher Reeve, who is going to require, if he lives out a normal lifespan, a tremendous amount of effort and a tremendous amount of money just to keep him alive? That's not even counting what it might cost us. And we're not talking about someone who has the money, but someone who doesn't. What it's going to cost us, not only just to keep them alive, but to try and work toward their recovery. That's additional cost, effort, isn't it? You see, that ethic, if it were strictly followed, would fairly well require us to leave such a person, if they fell off a horse like Christopher Reeve and broke their neck and were rendered quadriplegic, leave that person to die. That would serve the greatest good for the greatest number of people, because in the long run, it would cost us much less in terms of our commitment, our money, and our resources. See, Christopher Reeve can only make that argument from the position of someone who can pay for his own care. And he can only make that argument from the position of someone who is depending upon others to sacrifice of their good for his good. You see the inconsistency. Now, I'd be happy to open up the phone lines here until we are able to reach our guest, Dr. Nigel Cameron, to talk about biotechnology. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Let's start with Kathy, who calls from St. Charles. Kathy, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Pastor. Thank you for taking my call. I had a discussion the other day with a woman who has a child with special needs, and I, too, have a child with special needs, and she was saying how, because of the chromosomal defect in her child and in mind, how she supports embryonic stem cell research, and she was looking forward to hearing Carrie here locally and at Edwards, I think it is. And I just told her, you know, the opposite of her stance, and that basically, you know, what you said, you know, just because we can do it doesn't mean we should. And I said, you know, I said, you realize in history when this has been done in the past, the children or people who were first looked at as those who were expendable were children just such as ours, children with Down syndrome, children with chromosomal problems, or, you know, children who were retarded. I said, you know, to me, that's just wrong. But the other thing was, I told her, just because you, I said, you shouldn't kill your neighbor to help your neighbor. And I guess that's the bottom line for me. If you have to kill an embryo, which we were all embryos at one point in our life, to help someone else, that is just absurd. I mean, you wouldn't go out today and do that. If somebody needed a heart, you don't go out and kill somebody else who's got a good one. I mean, it's just absolutely absurd.
Well, the only way, Kathy, and you know this as well as I do, that someone can come to the conclusion that it's worth it, that it is permissible to take one life to save another life, the only way they come to that is if they can consider the life that they're taking worth less or worthless.
Right, and that's where I brought up the point, you know, when this first took place in, you know, in recent history, in Nazi Germany, it was the mentally retarded, the mentally, you know, infirmed that were considered worthless.
Kathy, I got a question before I let you go. You said that the friend of yours also had, I think, a Down syndrome.
Is
that correct? A Down syndrome child.
Mm-hmm.
And she was in favor of embryonic stem cell research. What was her reasoning? What was the, connect the dots for me, if she did, between I've got a Down syndrome child, therefore I think embryonic stem cell research is a good idea. How did she rationalize that?
She really didn't. It was very vague. She just felt that it would, she said, you know, if it would help your son, if it would help your son, the embryonic stem cell, why wouldn't you do it? And I said, you know, even if it would help him with that, with his autism, with celiac sprue, I wouldn't do it because I said, you know, and she knows I would personally benefit because I have celiac sprue. And I said, you know, it just isn't right to kill your neighbor. But she did not connect the dots.
Kathy,
and she just said, her response to me once I said that was, well, that's your opinion.
Well, one of those opinions is right and one of them is wrong. Kathy, thank you very much for the call. There are two things at work here, folks, and I want you to understand this because if we get Dr. Cameron on here, it's one of the things he's written about. He has talked about what he calls, let me see if I can find the page where he talks about this. He calls this a technological vagueness, I think is what he calls it, where we are, here it is, technology and ignorance is what he calls it. The technology is moving so fast, and while it's moving fast, it's making promises, or its proponents are making promises. So that a woman like this can look at her child, for whom embryonic stem cell research holds absolutely no promise. Embryonic stem cell research at this point, if it holds any promise at all, and its promises are generally hollow, only holds promise for people who have diabetes, perhaps Parkinson's. Now the cost, if you want to do cost-benefit analysis, is mind-boggling. The number of embryos that have to be destroyed to save and we don't even know how to do this yet, a single victim of Parkinson's, a single victim of diabetes. They blow your mind. But see, the technology and the promise is presented in such a vague way so that everyone feels like they have hope in this technology. Remember yesterday we heard from, or a day before yesterday we heard from John Kerry, who was on the campaign trail. He was talking about embryonic stem cell research, and he named two diseases in connection with embryonic stem cell research and held out hope for cures of two diseases for which embryonic stem cell research holds no cure whatsoever. He talked about Alzheimer's and AIDS. Neither of which, not even the researchers in favor of, not even the most adamant proponents of embryonic stem cell research will promise you that AIDS or Alzheimer's can be cured by embryonic stem cell research. Here is this, and I feel terrible for this woman, Kathy's friend, who has listened to the vague promises made by the proponents of embryonic stem cell research and believed that perhaps even her own son might have benefited or would benefit from it. You see, this is part of the problem here, the ignorance of what the technology is and what the promises really are. And when we come back from this break, we'll take more of your phone calls at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I'd like to respond to one other thing that Kathy had to say there. You see, it's a two-edged sword, this utilitarian ethic. While it purports to be the great champion of cures for the sick, it also requires, by the same logic, the destruction of the unfit. We'll talk about that when we come back.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Does prayer bring God to me? Is prayer a pipeline of communication between a believer and God? And is that pipeline a two-way street? You'll find answers to these questions in our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for August, Is God Listening? It's written by Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Andrew Steinman. Visit our website, issuesetc.org, for more information or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Is God Listening? Costs $9.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040. Does God decide how to answer requests based on how many people are praying? Find out with the book, Is God Listening? By Dr. Andrew Steinman. When you order, tell them, I listen to Issues, Etc., and I want the book of the month for August. The title is God Listening? Issuesetc.org or 1-800-325-3040.
This Global Minute lets you hear about a man from South Asia who is passionate to study God's Word. Bobathar is from the country of Myanmar, formerly known as Burma. It's just northeast of India, and about 3 years ago, he and another person walked over the border and into India. Their goal was to find a Bible college, and they ventured into the Indian state of Manipur, where they took a bus and then trained for 1,000 miles until they came to the India Evangelical Mission Bible College. Bobathar just graduated with a 3-year Bachelor of Theology degree and is excited that he has new skills for serving God and learning His Word. IEM trains evangelists for ministry in India and South Asia. Pray that the recent graduates will have a great impact. Dig deeper into India with a brochure called To India with Love. Call 1-800-268-0461. That's 800-268-0461.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. A favorite story of mine comes from Carla, who always delights to tell me about the latest exploits of her granddaughter, Lisa. When Lisa was 2 years old, she and Carla were watching a Shirley Temple movie. Suddenly, Lisa popped up and, motioning to a crucifix on the wall, said she wanted to hold Jesus. So Carla got up, took down the crucifix, and gave it to Lisa to hold. Looking at that figure of Jesus on the cross, Lisa pointed to his feet and said, "Boo-boo." Then she pointed to the hands of Jesus and repeated, "Boo-boo." Then 2-year-old Lisa kissed both Jesus' hands and his feet. That's the kind of story that melts the heart. In the first century, St. Peter wrote to people who were caught up in all the things of daily life, just as we're caught up in all the things of daily life. Remember, he wrote, that it was not with perishable things such as silver or gold that you were redeemed from the empty way of life you inherited, but with the precious blood of Christ. 1 Peter 1:18 and 19. Jesus' boo-boos earned our forgiveness. In the midst of all our adult doings, it's not a childish thing to let our hearts be melted by the great love God has for each of us. I'm Dale Meyer.
Hi, this is Paul Clayton. I bring you news and information, inspirational Christian favorites, and conversations with great guests Monday through Friday on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO. Plus, short features like, By the Way, our thought for the day from the Reverend Paul Devanteer, Front Porch Parenting with Dr. Mary Mance Simon, commentary from Dr. Dale Meyer, it's The Meyer Minute, plus Your Creation Moment, features on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm going to take another phone call here, respond a little bit more to Kathy, and then we're going to be joined by someone who'd like to respond to the California Supreme Court decision. They voided the same-sex marriage licenses that were issued, some 4,000 of them that were issued this year in San Francisco. The story is big. You heard about it. We'll find out what this will mean in just a few minutes. We will be talking about that. And then a little bit later in the program, we'll be talking about confession and absolution. We'll be talking about Christian vocation as well here on Issues, Etc. Before we go back to the phones, Kathy raised one other thing that needs a response, and that is the same logic that would say, from a utilitarian ethic, that would say, look, we need to be working for the greatest number of good, greatest good for the greatest number of people. Therefore, let's do embryonic stem cell research, even if there's a possibility that it might cure you fill in the blank. That same logic, if consistently employed, also requires something else. It's a two-edged sword. It cuts both ways. It both promises cure and care for certain people, but it also denies cure and care to others. Because if you're working for the greatest good for the greatest number of people, there will be people who will be deemed in that cost-benefit analysis not worthy of your care and not worthy of a cure. Because that utilitarian ethic is, at its very heart, nothing but cost-benefit analysis. So that the same logic that could offer a cure to, say, a Down syndrome kid, which embryonic stem cell research doesn't, but even if it did, could offer and promise a cure to a Down syndrome child, could also, by the same logic, say, look, the Down syndrome child is too tough, the cure is too expensive, therefore, they are expendable. they don't serve the greatest good, they should go. It's a two-edged sword. Back to the phones. Bill is calling from his car. Bill, thank you for your patience. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, sir. I'm just wondering, all the proponents of pro-choice people and the proponents of stem cell research, is there any consensus you know of among these folks as to when human life begins, or is it just a matter of just not really caring and throwing the baby. Well, that's not a good phrase. What I'm asking is, do you think these people realize that they are murdering people and really don't care about
that
it?
That is a good question, Bill.
Thank you.
It's hard. I can't get into their heads, but I'll tell you one thing. I have observed that we have crossed a threshold in this debate, be it abortion or embryonic stem cell research. The threshold that we have crossed over the last 5 years or so is from people who are arguing it isn't human, it isn't a life, it's just a lump of cells. Now, the very, very ignorant might still argue that. The people who haven't read a newspaper in 5 years might still argue that. That's the old argument. The new argument is, yes, it is a human being, but maybe it's not a person. Or, yes, it is a human being, and in fact a person, but this embryo, be it for abortion or for embryonic stem cell research, hasn't yet begun, and here's a person who already has begun, and they've already got their lease on life, and they need the cure that the death of this little embryo might provide. Or this woman who's already started her life, and she doesn't want it ruined by the unwelcome birth of a baby. This little baby hasn't started life yet. We're not really giving up that much. You see, we've crossed the threshold from saying it's not a life, therefore it isn't worthy of protection, to saying, and this is being said more often than not, Bill, yes, it is a life, but it's still not worthy of protection. And that is a crucial threshold to have crossed. A deadly one, in fact. Thanks for your question, Bill. For the remainder of this hour, we're going to be talking with Karen Holgate. She's Director of Legislative Affairs for the California Family Council. You have certainly heard the story, top news today, that the California Supreme Court has decided to void more than 4,000 gay marriage licenses that were issued earlier this year in the city of San Francisco. Karen Holgate joins us. Karen, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. And before we go to that, can I comment on the whole stem cell debate?
Oh, sure, if you wish to.
Well, first of all, in California, we have a proposition on the ballot this time that wants to actually fund $3 billion to do embryonic stem cell research. And so we're fighting that out here. But I do want to point out to people, because we're faced with this, is that there's a big, big difference between embryonic stem cell research and adult stem cell research. So people who say, you know, you're against embryonic, so you're against stem cell research, that's a lie. And I think when we're talking about this, we need to differentiate between that. They've had tremendous successes in curing people with adult stem cell research, with cord blood stem cells. They've had all kinds of success with almost 75 different diseases. There has never been any success stories with embryonic stem cells. So we need to make that very clear when we're talking to people about this whole issue.
You're absolutely right, Karen. Well said, and thank you for pointing that out. And, by the way, we are certainly keeping our eye and our concern upon that $3 billion of taxpayer money that would supposedly go to fund embryonic stem cell research.
Yeah, well, that's about funding cloning.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what that whole thing's about. So that's another battle we have. But we do have a great success here in California. I know people didn't expect it, but we did.
Well, you have a fair number of battles out there on all fronts, and the battle that was being fought in San Francisco earlier this year had to do with the mayor there issuing licenses without any real authority to gay couples for marriage. What did the Supreme Court decide there in California?
Well, first of all, we're just thrilled to death that a court in California finally decided to rule on the side of law, you know, rather than rule on the side of their own personal bias. So we are thrilled that the state Supreme Court said that Mayor Newsom violated state law, has no authority to, sanction those marriage ceremonies, and basically all those people who were given fraudulent marriage licenses are null and void.
Now, I don't want to take the shine off the apple. But what they, you know, what the court decided to do, as far as I can tell from what you said, is to basically say the mayor couldn't have issued these licenses. He had no standing or authority to do such a thing.
Exactly.
They did not make any binding or abiding decision about whether or not California in the future should, through the proper channels, be able to issue marriage licenses.
Exactly. They stayed completely away from the constitutional issue. And so that's another battle we're going to have to fight. But it has been a tremendous boost to the people and to the effort here in California. And people may not be aware outside of the state, but we actually had two state legislators, an assemblyman and a state senator, one who's a gay male and the other who's a lesbian, perform over 100 illegal marriages during that whole fiasco and bragged about it, and that's in complete violation of state law that says they cannot perform those kinds of marriages. So that's a whole other issue we need to go after. But we are sick and tired of people, especially elected officials, thumbing their noses at our laws and getting away with it. So from our perspective, the Supreme Court decision today was truly a rule in favor of families and a rule in favor of the rule of law.
So, Karen, where does California law at this point, given the fact that there still is some question to be answered, where does it stand at this point vis-a-vis same-sex marriage?
Well, unfortunately, we have basically given them all the rights other than the name. We passed a law just last year. It's called Assembly Bill 205. And what it did, it effectively changes every state code that has anything to do with marriage, whether it's benefits in business, family leave, all those kinds of things have to be changed to include domestic partners, they're calling themselves. So that bill will take effect, or that law will take effect in January of next year. So without giving them the name, that law passed and basically gives them all the same benefits that marriage couples have now.
Would you say that that is an official recognition in the state of California legally of civil unions?
Certainly. Certainly, because what they did in California, they found out that they used to call them civil unions, but they found that that did not play well with the people in California. So what they did, they just went back, amended some previous legislation, dropped the term civil unions, and started using the term domestic partners, domestic partnerships, and we have passed, you know, much more favorably using that term. And so that's what they've done here in the state.
Let's deal with the three different branches of government there in California and apply the same question to all three of them. If the Supreme Court of California were to hear a case about recognizing a gay marriage, say, that was performed in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. where gay marriage is permitted, and they didn't have the question of whether or not a mayor could issue a license or anything like that, they were simply deciding up and down on the constitutionality of gay marriage in the state of California, how do you think they would come out?
That's going to be interesting. Our Supreme Court, believe it or not, is a little more conservative than any of our appellate courts. And so it's going to be interesting to see what they will do, because that is an issue that's before them, the constitutionality of all this. And I'm not quite sure where they will fall down, because we just don't know where they're going to stand on it. This, like I said, is encouraging. We just don't know. It's very frightening. And I don't think in California, I know Missouri just had a great success in passing a constitutional amendment. Some other states are considering it right now. At California, I don't know if we would have the two-thirds vote it would require to add a constitutional amendment to our state constitution, but it is something we're looking at.
We're talking with Karen Holgate, Director of the Legislative Affairs for California Family Council, about California Supreme Court's decision today to void more than 4,000 gay marriages or gay marriage licenses issued by the city of San Francisco earlier this year. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-7850. 2727. Karen, in that assembly bill that you mentioned before, did it define what a domestic partner would be? Did it exclude anything from what someone might want to call, well, here's my domestic partner. This is my gay lover. This is my brother from across town. This is my pet dog.
Yeah, actually it did. And what happened is this has been an ongoing process. So AB 205 didn't enact that. We had a previous bill that was enacted a couple of years ago that actually defined domestic partnerships and gave them legal status. And in California, a domestic partner is anyone of the same sex at any age. Okay, I mean, once they're adults, not under 18. But it's interesting that a domestic partner for a heterosexual couple is only legal if they're over age 62. Now figure that one out.
So, in other words, common law marriages are only, I guess you could put it in other terms, common law marriages, civil unions for heterosexuals are only apply to people
if
over 62?
Uh-huh. So if you're a heterosexual and you want to file as a domestic partner and have all those benefits, you must be 62 years of age or older.
I don't want to sound facetious here, but wouldn't that, by the logic of the other side on this debate, be discriminatory?
Well, wouldn't you think so? And we raised that during the hearings, and, you know, we were told that we didn't know what we were talking about, that, of course, the liberals in our state legislature would never discriminate against anybody.
Now, I asked about
and then they voted for the bill.
I asked about the Supreme Court's mind on gay marriage in general. What about the state assembly's mind on gay marriage in general? How do you gauge it?
Oh, well, our state assembly is extremely liberal right now. We have five homosexuals. We have our own gay caucus. And they have been moving this state consistently down the road since we had our first lesbian elected in the mid-1990s. So they would love to pass. In fact, we have a gay marriage bill coming up again. It will be reintroduced in December of this year for our next session. And Mark Leno, who is a gay male, has already said he will bring that back. So we will be fighting this again next year.
Now, what about the governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger? What has he expressed in terms of an opinion or a willingness to sign legislation when it comes to gay marriage?
Gee, on which day? He's an interesting guy. I like a lot of things he does. I don't like a lot of things he does. On the gay marriage issue, he will follow the will of the people. He was asked kind of off the cuff one day that, of course, got reported that he personally does not care whether they're married or not or what status, but that he will follow the will of the people. So my gut feeling is that he will still veto a gay marriage bill. But until he does it, we don't know, because we've seen him go back and forth on either side of any number of issues, quite frankly. So we won't rest assured until we see whether we get a veto from him or not.
What is your response to the basic argument that was put forth by Mayor Newsom in the Supreme Court case that the same-sex couples have a, quote-unquote, fundamental right to marry, and that's what compelled him as the mayor of San Francisco to act in the way that he did by issuing licenses?
Well, first of all, the Supreme Court just ruled that he didn't have the ability to determine the fundamental right of same-sex people, and he does not have the right to decide for himself what the law should be and enact his own version of it. And so, you know, that's just his own personal belief. And as an elected official, he is supposed to adhere to the law. He did not do it. And quite frankly, in California, we're getting very tired of individuals making their own set of rules and laws. And that's what's happened. And that, again, goes back to why we're so thrilled that the Supreme Court ruled against him, because it's not his place to determine the fundamental right of same-sex people.
The city attorney for San Francisco, Dennis Herrera, is quoted as saying, "Ultimately, we believe that when we deal with the issue of the constitutionality of same-sex marriage in California, Mayor Newsom's position will be vindicated at the end of the day.
Well, the reality is that he should wait until the courts decide. He should wait until the law backs him up. They do not have, again, the right to step out and just violate state laws. And to me, there should be consequences for that. I mean, they violated the law. To me, they should be going beyond just ruling that he didn't have the authority. They should be acting against somebody who violated law.
You're listening to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking to Karen Holgate of the California Family Council. We're talking to her about California's Supreme Court's decision today to render void more than 4,000 gay marriage licenses issued by the city of San Francisco earlier this year. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. One other quote that I'd like you to respond to, see if you concur. Matthew Staver, who is from the Campaign for California Families, he said, quote, instead of helping his cause, Mayor Newsom has set back the same-sex marriage agenda and laid the foundation for the pro-marriage movement to once and for all win this battle to preserve traditional marriage. Would you go so far?
I don't know about the once and for all. I think we have an ongoing battle here in California. And until we have a constitutional amendment, I think we're going to keep battling this. And even then, that's going to get challenged. I think we're going to see this issue for the next few years until we do get some rulings, and we're going to have to eventually have the constitutional amendment.
Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Harold is on the line calling from his car. Harold, welcome.
Yes. Todd?
Yes. What's your question or comment, Harold?
Well, the way I understand this is that the war, if the Supreme Court voided all the marriages, but they still got the monetary benefits by having Social Security or whatever they would get by being a married couple, is that correct?
Yes, that law that I just talked about will take effect next year. They don't have them right now, but it will take effect next year. And you would think, because that has always been their argument, is that, you know, we deserve the same protections. Our family is a family no different than yours. Our children need protections, blah, blah, blah. And you would think from their arguments that they would be satisfied with that. The reality is they want the name marriage. I really believe, and this is my personal belief, that they believe if they can have that name, that they will win the acceptance in society that they so badly want, and that it will give them equal status. And I have to tell you, from a personal point of view, that as long as they are living outside of God's law and God's rule, even if all of society embraced them and said this is wonderful, they would still not be and have the happiness and the acceptance and the peace that they seek because they're outside God's law and God's rule.
So when it comes to when the end of the day has come, you expect the battle to continue until either the Constitution or the Supreme Court there in California says yes or no to the term marriage for same-sex couples.
It's, yes.
That is really the point here.
That is the point. They want that name that they've got. In California, they have all the other things they want. Until they have the name, this battle is going to continue.
Dave is calling from his car. Dave, welcome to Issues Etc. We'll get Dave back here if we can. What becomes then of these marriage licenses that were issued in San Francisco? I mean, they're void, but what does that mean in real terms?
Well, in real terms, it means that they do not have marriage status. And it's interesting because some couples were already suing their businesses because they wanted them to have all the benefits they get next year anyway, but they wanted them now, family leave, health benefits, all of those things. And so now any challenges that they've had to their employers, that's going to go away. So they won't have that. And also, I have to tell you, a key issue for us, and I think not just in California, but throughout the nation where this is an issue, is if we once legalize, and people ask me, well, if in California, if they've already given them all the benefits, why are you fighting so strongly to retain the name marriage as being between a man and a woman? And we're fighting because of the message it sends to our children. If we as a state, as a legal entity, say there is no difference between marriage between a man and a woman and marriage between a man and a man or a woman and a woman, we have in effect told a whole generation of children that God's law does not stand for anything, and that we as a culture say that there is no difference. And I don't think we can afford to send that message to our children. We have to stand for what is right and for righteousness, or we're going to doom our children to not having that line in the sand in standing themselves for what's right.
Karen, with only 10 seconds, what are the prospects of a constitutional amendment in California to define marriage as a man and a woman?
It won't happen anytime soon. It's down the road, and we'll have to watch what other states do, and if the momentum builds, then we can probably do something here.
CaliforniaFamily.org is the website for the California Family Council. CaliforniaFamily.org. Karen Holgate has been kind enough to join us. She is Director of Legislative Affairs for California Family Council. Karen, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
When we come back from this break, music in the life of the church. Pastor David Johnson of Concordia Publishing House will join us to talk about, you know, because music doesn't just happen spontaneously in the church. It takes people who've had training, not only the people who sing in the choir or the people who play the organ or the piano or the instrumentalists. It requires a lot of preparation in advance. How does the church nurture the life of music in its midst in an everyday sense? What are the challenges facing a church musician where music is part of the church's worship life, and we are also variously gifted in that respect? What are the main challenges there, and what is the real role of music in the life of the church? We'll talk about that when we come back from this break in the second hour of Issues Etc. today. Then we'll be talking a little bit later about confession and absolution. We'll also be talking about Christian vocation here on Issues Etc. Feel free to join us in the next hour, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We take it for granted. It's always there on Sunday morning. We'll be talking about music in the life of the church after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.